The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Barton Simmons. That's Tom Fornelli. I'm Chip Patterson. We're opening up the big old bag of mail. We got some fun topics submitted by you to break down. But before we jump into topics that include the dream of the 90s, whether it'll become alive again, the top quarterbacks of the last decade, the Texas quarterback room, at least looking into the future, Michigan versus Michigan State, that in-state rivalry, and much more. Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Good. I will say that this is, I'm very appreciative of our listeners for all the questions, because the mailbags have been, I think, fun questions, and they've carried us in the off season here. I actually enjoyed preparing for this pod too. I think that there's some good discussions on the horizon. So thank you everyone that's been posting comments and questions and 5-star reviews. Kick rocks anyone that's been posting 1 or 2-star reviews.
Chip haters out here.
We don't want you anyways. And secondarily speaking, and I've talked about how like the quarantine has made me appreciate some things that like didn't used to appreciate, like potato chips. Well, I'm starting to lose interest in music. Like, I'm bored with it all.
Mm.
So if you guys, if there's anything that I should be listening to right now, I feel like all the music out there is just, I've just listened to it all at this point. So I need a good lead on something I can listen to while I'm prepping for a podcast or watching film.
I listen to a lot of Spotify playlists.
How do you find a good playlist? Like the mood playlist, like, oh yeah, like here's like the, here's how this like happy at work playlist or whatever.
Even those. I listen mostly to like a lot of instrumental playlists. Like I'm not, most of the music I'm listening to
so
lately doesn't have lyrics. No, it's just, it's better for, cause I spend most of my day reading. You know what I mean? Like if I'm online working, I'm usually reading things or I'm writing things, because that's essentially what my job comes down to. So if I'm listening to music, I find that if I'm listening to stuff with lyrics, it kind of can be distracting. Whereas if I'm just listening to instrumental stuff, it's kind of like background noise and it helps, you know, erase everything else and helps me focus on what I'm reading or writing. It helps me keep my attention more than anything.
Do you feel like you've listened to all the David Bowie? You're done with David Bowie? You're good there?
No, I did dabble in like 80s hairband rock, and that was actually a good change of pace, and it was a productive couple days. And I'm not opposed to going back into that well, but like I don't want to become just like 80s hair rock guy who like that's all he listens to is 80s hair rock. So, you know, that's always there, but
what about Sly and the Family Stone? Like mostly everything before 1971. Like he released one album in 67, two in 68. One of them, Stand, that has a couple radio hits that you'd know. Then of course there's a riot going on in 70 or 71. Like basically the first 3 or 4 Sly and the Family Stone albums I would recommend. I'm going through my recently played right now. Have you done Avett Brothers?
I've done the folk kind of country stuff. You know, I've sort of been in that genre.
Have you done Aretha Franklin? Prince?
That's just straight like wedding rock.
Oh, no, dude. Aretha Franklin covering other people's music, she does them better than the originals.
All right. That's something maybe worth to dig in on.
Billy Preston. You
know, I had a good little reggae sesh for a couple days there. Nice. But I just don't know what reggae to explore. Like, it was just reggae playlist. So you got some good reggae for me? Like, maybe
Have you ever heard of this guy named Bob Marley?
No, but on that note, Peter Tosh, you can chase that one. Like, yeah, get into Peter Tosh. Like, you can trace the tentacles and the extension of the Bob Marley music tree and find a lot of a lot of good, really, really, really good reggae music that isn't the same Bob Marley songs that you've probably heard time and time again. Have you done Curtis Mayfield?
No, you're like a big Motown guy, aren't you?
Curtis Mayfield's like a little bit more soul funk, but yeah. I mean, I probably float around.
Maybe that generally speaking, like, that is one of my go-to
exactly
genres.
Motown.
All right, so that's not a typical genre I go to. So maybe I need to explore that, you know, test the waters there, see if that can scratch the itch.
Go ahead.
Going back to what you said about Aretha Franklin and her covers are better than the original versions. Here's a hot take. Here's a cover that's better than the original version. You know the song Word Up by Cameo?
Yes.
Korn's cover is like 10 times better than the original version. It is.
Hey,
there's
respect.
No disputing it.
Korn gets grouped into new metal, but diehard Korn fans have good arguments for that they had some bangers that got lost and grouped in with a lot of trash from the time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to sit here. Like, I listened to Korn a lot when I was that age and they were, you know, still out there before. I mean, they're still around, but I haven't listened to them in a long time. But they were unfairly grouped into something that they kind of helped create. And then was followed by a whole lot of bad, and they just got kind of lumped in, where it's like, no, they were always better than those bands.
All right, one last recommendation, then we'll dig in. Have you done Talking Heads?
No.
Oh, you have to do Talking
Great
Heads.
Great work music, too, because so much of it's so up-tempo.
Okay. You guys are
I've been listening to Talking Heads since I was a wee little boy, because my dad listened to Talking Heads in the 80s, so I've loved them my whole life.
All right, Talking Heads. What was the reggae guy? Tom Marsh?
No, Peter Tosh.
Peter Tosh. Okay. Tom Marsh. Peter Tosh doesn't sound that much like more like edgy than Tom Marsh.
I don't think it's his real name, but.
And Aretha Franklin. All right, so I got my three go tos. Well, I'll report back and see if that.
Have you listened to RTJ4?
No, I don't know who that is.
Run the Jewels.
Run the Jewels.
Oh! I didn't know the lingo. I've dabbled there. Yeah,
that's a very good album.
Yeah, throw that one on there too. All
also
right.
Very timely.
Indeed, very timely. And speaking of timely, you might have heard that there is a golf tournament going on. That's right. This is your Power 3 moment on the Cover 3 podcast. And look, we'll all be able to bet on football soon enough, but how about some golf action to carry you over until the fall? You can win $1,000 without putting down any of your own money. CBS Sports has a brand new golf prop game with questions for every round. You can still make your plays for rounds 2 through 4 at the Travelers Championship. Just head to cbssports.com/golf for more. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that is cbssports.com/golf for the new golf prop game where you can win $1,000 without putting down any of your own money. Let's dig on in. First question. Coming, love this on the back of Mavericks, fighter pilots, bus drivers. This one comes from Iceman. I noticed that this is the first year that there's an international tab in the 24/7 state dropdown, and there seem to be more recruits from Europe going to Power 5 schools. Do you think that places like Europe or Australia could become regular recruiting spots for college football coaches? This is something that's happened in D1 basketball, and there are programs like Gonzaga that have built a lot of their success off of recruiting internationally when not everyone was doing it. Is there an opportunity for a school that doesn't have a ton of in-state talent to increase their roster talent by going over to Europe?
Yes, there is an opportunity, but not in the same way Gonzaga has. If the European football thing explodes, then we're like still like 50 years away from that being a legitimate pipeline to build top end teams. But if you are UMass, then hell yeah, go get some guys from Europe. If you are, I mean, we're seeing like the Temples of the world are doing it. Like West Virginia's gotten a couple guys of late that are pretty good players. There are dudes over there, but it's still like you don't want to like fill your roster with a bunch of European football players. Like the thing, I went over there last spring.
I was going to say camp. This is right up your wheelhouse because you were just in Amsterdam for a camp, right?
A year ago. Unfortunately, obviously the circumstances prevented anything and will probably prevent a lot of recruiting over there this cycle because coaches were going over there too and visiting and seeing players. So I loved it. It was awesome because the kids over there are like so eager and excited about being part of the football universe, and they're super mature. They're incredibly motivated and they are they're disciplined, and they have like kind of a little bit of more diverse athletic skill set, but they're also really raw. Some are a little mechanical. So I just, you know, you don't want to like find like I was a little like Penn State's got gotten a couple guys over there. I'm a little surprised it's worth Penn State's time. I'm not at all surprised it's worth Temple's time. It's worth UMass's time. Maybe it's worth like West Virginia's time, but it's you know, it's definitely a little bit of a gamble, and you're not going to find someone every year. But if you find a good one, then that's, you know, that's a easier pool to fish out of than Atlanta, Metro Atlanta.
Okay, well, you say it's going to be like 50 years or whatever. What about Australia's punter industrial complex now?
I mean, that's a different deal. Like, I'm actually talking about the position players in Europe that don't come to America for JUCO or prep school or whatever, just are recruited out of Europe. Mm-hmm. The kickers and the punters out of Australia, it's absurd how much that has been that business has been perfected. Like, everyone's getting their punters from over there. Like,
yeah, if you don't have an Australian punter, you're behind.
Yeah, no, like the kicking and punting game is a totally different deal.
Does that?
But there's two really good Canadians that were signed this year. Theo Johnson went to Penn State. He's going to be a stud at tight end. And Ajoa Joe is a kid who went to Clemson as a receiver, played his senior year in maybe his junior and senior year in Florida, but originally from Canada. Those guys have a chance to be elite special players, and there's a couple more in that cycle. So there are some good players, but is it worth the squeeze? Is it worth the effort? That's sort of the calculation you got to make.
Is that going to end up being a little bit regional in the fact that East Coast schools are going to be able to go and get players from Europe and West Coast schools might have advantages from Australia? Although the punter complex, as you mentioned, has been going all across the country.
No, the punter deal, like those kids just get like placed. Like it's not even about, like it's about like there's the Pro Kick Australia is the name of the group that kind of places these guys. And I think, I don't know, I need to dig on that a little bit. I think they basically are just, they just tell these kids where they're going. And it's like, you know, they it's like a matchmaker service with the school and with these 28-year-old tatted up like men that have been Australian rules rugby players professionally for the last 6 years. And they're just like, all right, you're going to go to Georgia Tech.
It's an arranged marriage.
Yeah. it's kind of wild, but those guys, they pan out.
Hey, if you're tight with the right coach, like that is the old, like get tight with the high school coach taken to the nth degree.
In terms of getting tight with the high school coach in Australia.
Like, yeah,
I don't know how they decide who gets the best players. I think maybe it's just, yeah, maybe that's what it is. You know, Utah's been hanging out there the longest. So Utah, you get
first
number
pick.
One seed. Whoever has the most loyalty to us beyond, like, I don't know. I'm just guessing on that. But there clearly is some sort of arrangement where they just ship these guys off.
All right. Next question. Hey guys, love the pod and thank you for being one of my few sources of sports entertainment over the last few months. You're welcome. On this week's show, y'all discuss Nebraska as an underrated storyline this upcoming season. I think of Nebraska and Tennessee as two similar programs over the last 30 years. Both dominated in the 90s, but now have struggled to meet fan expectations for over a decade. Also, both Pruitt and Frost were hired in the same year. What team do you think emerges back into national championship slash playoff contention first? Also, that underrated storylines episode, go download it if you haven't. Good discussion on Nebraska, among other topics, as we drafted the news. So Nebraska or Tennessee, what do we think?
It's a tough call.
I don't think it is.
Well, what do you think?
Tennessee. I'm going to take a snapshot, and I'm going to expand it way bigger than it should be. But, and I think I've said this before, but Nebraska, the way that Tennessee brought the fight to Alabama, its number one rival, the class of the SEC. Like, yes, they definitely ended up losing that game. And, you know, there's still some distance for Tennessee to go before I'm going to consider them a college football playoff contender. But when I consider that that is the distance of how you measure yourself to the top of the SEC versus Nebraska against Ohio State, it's like the gap between Nebraska and Ohio State, I think, is bigger than the gap between Tennessee and Alabama.
I get it. I think that in a vacuum, Tennessee is closer right now than Nebraska is, just based on the current state of the programs, the way that they're recruiting, et cetera. I just think that the one thing you have to consider, though, is for Tennessee to get to the playoff and to become a national title contender, it's got to go through Georgia and Florida every single year in its division. And then if it manages to do that and gets to the SEC championship, it's going to have to get through an Alabama, an LSU, an Auburn, and maybe, as we're seeing, a Texas A&M. So there are a lot of other teams that it has to compete with, not just nationally, but within its own conference. Whereas in the Big Ten, Nebraska is not as far along as Tennessee. But I think that if you look at their division, they don't have nearly as tall of a mountain to climb because, yeah, Wisconsin's good. We all know that. And Iowa has good years. But I don't think that those are two programs that you consider to be title contenders, whereas Tennessee has two title contending programs within its own division. So I feel like Nebraska, as far as that is concerned, is closer than Tennessee. So I think I look at it from talent-wise, program-wise, Tennessee is closer. Position-wise, as far as where you are at a conference, I feel like Nebraska is closer. So that's why it's hard for me to really have a final. I probably lean towards Tennessee being more likely, but I don't think the gap is that large.
How is the question phrased? Who's closer to getting back to the glory years? Or what was the question?
What team do y'all think emerges back into national playoff, national championship slash playoff contention first?
Yeah. Okay. So to me, easily Tennessee. Tennessee right now is the number three recruiting class in the country. Nebraska is the number 41 recruiting class in the country. That's a snapshot. That can all change. It's one class. Like, I don't want to don't get hung up on that. But I'm just saying, like, it's a visual of what drives national championships. And Tennessee has got his foot on the gas trying to recruit at that level. And Nebraska, it's tougher to recruit at that level at Nebraska based on geography and location. And certainly in this climate, it's even more so. But Tennessee is in the footprint that it can recruit at that level. It has a staff that's capable of recruiting at that level. And yes, it's going to be a harder climb. But I think that's sort of like the particularly as the question is phrased that way. Like, I think right now Nebraska is, I'm not saying there aren't steps in between these things, but like Nebraska right now, our visualization of Nebraska finally getting back, mine, I'll speak for myself. Nebraska getting back is getting on a Wisconsin level. And Tennessee getting back is, I think it can be, if it's contending for the SEC East, it's back. If you're contending for the SEC East, you're contending for a national championship. And so I think, like, you know, the good news is who's Nebraska competing against? Well, Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, Northwestern, Purdue, like all of those teams don't have a great recruiting base either. So the climb to the top of the division may be easier for Nebraska, but ultimately the climb to get to a national championship contending level, I think we're seeing this. There's more encouraging steps on that front at Tennessee right now than there is in Nebraska.
Mm, what what would be, so winning the SEC East is probably the first signifier of backness for Tennessee.
Yeah, and, but again, if you win the SEC East, it is the first signifier of backness, but it's also like you are by definition in contention for the playoffs.
Here, right? I mean,
I guess not necessarily.
I could also counter with Mizzou won the SEC East a couple times in the last decade. Would you consider them to be a national title contender at the time?
I was going
to
say the Jim McElwain Florida teams both showed up to Atlanta as SEC East champions in, I think, 2015 and 2016, and neither one of those teams was sniffing college football playoff contention. They were just the sacrificial lamb to Alabama.
For sure, but I'm also thinking about the SEC East in like its present day form, where if you are contending for the SEC East, you're beating Georgia and Florida potentially. Like and I don't expect those two teams to have some down years ahead of us. Like those two teams look like they're accelerating right now, not slowing down.
So, sure.
I think it's harder, but I think it sort of goes back to my whole thing with Jeremy Pruitt is. The reason that I ranked him high in my coach rankings isn't necessarily because like what he's proven right now is that it's more about what his ceiling is. Like Jeremy Pruitt is not shooting for 8-4 seasons. Like he is he's shooting for 12-0. Like that's and I think he's either gonna get that or maybe he crashes and burns and you know, who knows what it looks like. But I think that the ceiling is there. And Nebraska, I think we're still kind of waiting to see if the ceiling is there. I mean, we're a long way away. Like the best Nebraska has been before Scott Frost is what, like since Tom Osborne, what's the best we've seen for Nebraska?
When nine and four kind of seasons under Pelini.
Yeah. And so I mean,
although they did play for a couple Big 12 titles.
Right. I was going to say
screwed out of one Big 12 title.
Taylor Martinez had them in the Big Ten championship game. That's the best it's been.
Mm-hmm. And like I said, in the Big 12 too, they were a friendly second on the clock away from probably beating Texas and winning a conference title.
In 2009?
So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and I guess, but you know, before someone calls me on this, I need to check myself too, because the best, like Tennessee's best is actually... It's not that impressive.
Not been great.
Yeah, so, I mean, 98, obviously. But since then, Fulmer had an 11-2 year. He had three other – so he had four 11 or 10 win seasons plus, over the next 10 years. But since Fulmer's been gone, 9-4 under Butch Jones is as good as we've gotten out of Tennessee either. So, you know, I acknowledge that, but I just feel like given – the recruiting base, there's more upside there, and it seems like we're pacing towards things at a quicker level than we are in Nebraska.
Yeah, I think that it's a good question and it's a fair question, but I also think that if we look at that recent history, like since in this century, since 2000, let's see, Nebraska has had 10 win seasons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, they've had 6. 10 win seasons since 2000. Since 2000, Tennessee, I don't think it's had a single one, has it?
Or no, they've had.
They've had one, two, three. They've had four. But the last one was in 2007. Nebraska's last 10 win season was in 2012.
Yeah.
Keep your eye on it. State. Which coach do you think are both coaches equally likely to be successful in their venture?
In their venture to compete for national championships?
We'll say even the first step to backness. Like, do you feel like both coaches have the same chance? Because I like how they drew the similarity. The question was asked by SAFGRG. So let's just call them SAF. The question from SAF was that it noted that both Pruitt and Frost were hired at the same time.
I think Pruitt's closer, but I also don't think that Pruitt had the kind of rebuild that Scott Frost had at Nebraska simply because, like I mentioned on the last show, going from spread to pro back to spread.
Yeah.
I think that's been a bigger rebuild for Nebraska than at Tennessee.
Yeah, the coaching search was a bigger mess than the roster he inherited. The roster he inherited was not bad.
Yeah, because Butch Jones, for all his faults at Tennessee, was not. It's not like he wasn't bringing in talented players. They had a good roster. The problem with the Butch Jones era was that Butch Jones was not doing enough with the talent that they had.
Hey, man, but those back-to-back nine-win seasons, it's glorious. Brick by brick. Get it done. All right, next question comes from SG. Love the podcast. There's been a debate on Twitter today about the best college QB between Newton, Manziel, Mariota, and Burrow. Who do you guys think is the best or top three QBs of the decade, either by season or career?
Newton, Manziel, Mariota, Burrow. Okay.
I think that there's one big, there's a name that's missing that's in my top three from that group.
So, all right. First of all, is the question who are our top three quarterbacks of the decade?
Yeah, that's the way that I thought that this would make for fun discussion. Top three quarterbacks of the decade, ranked.
Do you guys disagree with? Maybe you do. Here, I'll just tell you, I have my top two: one Burrow, two Cam. I know that they're both like one hit wonders. But those were the two best seasons I've ever seen by a quarterback.
That's my lifetime. That's my one and two. I've flipped it. I've got Cam 1, Burrow 2.
Okay.
Okay. See, this is funny because I agree. I think that single season, those are the two best seasons we saw from a quarterback in the decade. But I don't have either of them in my top three simply because they only played one season.
Yes. That's right up your alley. You do the same thing with coach rankings. You're all about like longevity, proven over time, such a stat head.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy to think that, you know, a larger sample and consistency is something that you should value instead of just, you know, an outlier. No, my three, and again, this is, I didn't include Cam and Joe. I think they had the best seasons single-handedly. It's just only one season at a time in the decade that matter. I mean, also actually, Joe had two seasons, and that first season was nowhere near the second season. So consistency. Anyway, my three are actually Andrew Luck, Baker Mayfield, and Deshaun Watson.
Andrew Luck.
No, he's got killer numbers in Tom's quarterback formula.
Oh, he wasn't even on my list.
He wasn't on my list either, but I knew he was going to come up.
Like, I understand Andrew Luck was a stud, but when I think about the decade, how many –
Andrew Luck
drop like dig routes like from Andrew Luck are flashing in my head. Like that is not the face of the decade to me.
If you took Andrew Luck and put him into the kind of offenses that these guys are playing in now, instead of being in what we talked about in the last episode that you loved so much about Stanford, the power smash mouth 250-pound running backs and 260-pound fullback offense that he was in, where it was mostly like a play action and only throwing between like 15 and 20 times a game. And you put that dude with his talent and his arm and an offense in which he was allowed to throw 35 to 40 times a game, he'd have had ridiculous numbers.
Well, we're not doing that, though. We're not hypotheticaling people into offenses.
No, I mean, my top three quarterbacks in the decade, not including Burrow and Cam, are Luck, Mayfield, and Deshaun, period.
I feel strongly about the Mayfield. I'm in on that.
I think Mayfield 100%.
And I gave longevity points there. In his 3 years at Oklahoma, I guess what would have been his sophomore season? I mean, he had the red shirt, so he'd already clearly been in around for a while. But sophomore season, number three passer rating in the country, 36 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. Junior season, number one passer rating in the country, 40 touchdowns, 8 interceptions. Senior year, number one passer rating in the country, 43 touchdowns, 6 interceptions. That is a 5.7 touchdowns for every pick average across all three seasons. The dude was bananas for so long. He was both like with Lincoln Riley as the OC and then also guiding them into the college football playoff in Lincoln Riley's year as a head coach.
All right. So I have Burrow 1, Cam 2. My third, here are the candidates I have for third. And maybe there's some East Coast bias. Maybe I should have Luck in there. Like, maybe you're right. I just, he is not the guy that is in my head when I think about the decade. So RG3 is a candidate. Manziel is a candidate. Watson, Mayfield, Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Kyler Murray. Those are my candidates for number three. In terms of what they accomplished on the field, and like, because part of the way I thought of this question is, when I'm watching a game, if I'm cheering for the opposing team, which quarterback do I feel most helpless watching? Like, there's nothing we can do. This guy is too good. And that player probably is Baker Mayfield. Like, if you just remember the way he could extend plays, the precision he played with, like, that was, I think, pretty special. But I'm a little bit tempted to go with Watson for three, because what he did was basically elevate an entire program. Like, we talk about the blue bloods and how hard it is to break into that club, and Deshaun Watson broke Clemson into that club, and made Clemson sort of maybe the team of the decade, one of the teams of the decade. That's a pretty lofty accomplishment to me.
Yeah, no, I think Watson is the best of. I would have, I mean, him and Mayfield, I think, are the obvious choices for that third spot. I will say with Mahomes, I didn't really consider Mahomes at all. I just think that obviously what he's done in the NFL has been, you know, holy crap, and he's very talented. He's got the huge arm, but if you look at Mahomes' numbers at Texas Tech and compare them to every single other Texas Tech quarterback, they don't really stand out. They're pretty much the same as everybody else.
That's interesting.
Well, I was thinking, as you were talking about the mentality of who do I feel helpless against, I was like, well, I don't feel helpless against Mahomes, because all you got to do is just hold the ball and just run for 4 yards per carry against the defense. Just keep it out of his hands. On the Deshaun point, I would say that the helpless feeling is exactly what Nick Saban felt when he felt the need to kick an onside kick to flip the game in 2015 when they won the national championship, and then watching Deshaun Watson march down the field in the final minutes, cool as a cucumber, running that offense against Alabama's defense that was winded and running out of air as he led them to the national championship. Watson, it's funny because they listed Manziel, who I believe was more of a like football culture phenomenon than somebody who I would consider best QB of the decade, especially when you compare them to the college football playoff appearances and national championships won by some of the others. Mariota was interesting. He was very, very good, but for some reason, I've still got him falling short of, like, I would put Watson right up there with Mayfield as well before I even got to Mariota.
Yeah, I think, in a weird way, I think Mariota's like goodness, which is not the right, but I just feel like Mariota's like success was pretty boring in a way. Like, wow, that guy's really good. And that, you know what I mean? It's like, you knew he was good. He was really good. He's one of the best. He won a Heisman for a reason, but you never felt like he was truly, you know, like transcendent in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Manziel to me is like, he was more exciting than great. Not that he wasn't great, but like in this terminology, and you know, Mariota, I do wonder how much Mariota and Jameis Winston's NFL careers have colored the way we look at their college careers. Cause they were their first and second pick in the draft, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, you know, that sort of speaks to, you know, Mariota did a little bit of what Clemson is doing right now in terms of elevating that program. They just didn't quite get over the hump. And obviously Jameis had one of the best seasons of all time, or one of the best teams of all time, that 2013 year.
Yeah. I remember when they came out, I was very much in the Jameis is the better QB now, and Marcus has the higher ceiling. And then it turns out they were both already at their ceiling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, they were already fully formed when they came out.
I think Jameis Winston's college perception was hurt by his redshirt sophomore season when he threw a bunch of picks.
Yeah, because that didn't prove to be predictive.
Like, he was so elite during that 2013 season when Florida State was one of the most dominant teams in college football history. But then remember during that whole 2014 season, they would just they were just kind of messing around with a lot of teams. Like every Florida State win, and Florida State was undefeated. I think they were the undefeated number three seed in the college football playoff in the 2014 season. And it is because they won so many games close. All right, Jameis Winston, passer rating, 2014, 27th in the country.
Yeah.
25 touchdowns to 18 interceptions. Prophetic. All right, coming up on the other side, more of your questions and our answers next.
Let's go! It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount Plus. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
The baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
This question is from Jeremy. I listened to the Drafting College Quarterbacks pod, and it gave me some hope that maybe you guys can quash. Jeez, he wants us to quash his hopes.
Gladly.
Even though nobody picked my man, Sam, he's a Texas fan. I recognize everyone was going for a stud senior with a young room to develop, and Ellinger probably missed the cut with only three senior quarterbacks to take as starters. But hearing Barton's stellar projection for Jaquindon Jackson and the following logic of building a program around a strong senior with a deep room of young guys, is it fair to put the quarterback outlook at Texas somewhere just behind Clemson? I was at Texas from 2010 to 2015, so I got the worst of the puzzling uncertainty at the position. Am I wrong for thinking we may be coming out of that? Love the podcast. You guys are doing great and keep me level during these uncertain times. Can't wait for the next season so there's actually more football to talk about. Okay, cool. Hook 'em.
I wouldn't. I don't think like you're just butting up against Clemson in the Texas quarterback room right now. I think the teams that are butting up against Clemson are Alabama, because like to me, either you have a guy that is a freak show, no doubt guy, or we're all guessing. And Clemson has Trevor Lawrence and a freak show, no doubt guy behind him, and DJ Uiagalelei. Alabama has Mac Jones, who is a capable starter and a freak show, no doubt guy, and Bryce Young behind him. So Clemson and Alabama are set for the next 3 years at least. With, in my opinion, I guess I could be wrong, but in my opinion, no doubt guys. I think Ohio State is pretty close to that level. I think C.J. Stroud could be that kind of a guy. And I think obviously they have Justin Fields. Spencer Rattler will find out this year, but he, could be a freak show. If he is, then that's at least two more years there. Like, I think those are the rooms that where we, like, because at the quarterback position, I don't know how far in advance you can really look, because you got a guy for X amount of years, and then who knows what the room will look like in 2 years. So those teams are all in great shape. I think the positive with Texas is you have, I think, behind Sam Ellinger, you have Jaquindon Jackson and Hudson Card, who are different quarterbacks, but both really talented, and both you could see hitting in like very different ways. And so you have, I think, diversity in your room. And like, you also have a guy, particularly in Jaquindon Jackson, like I said, who can, so yeah, in terms of depth, yeah, absolutely. But I still think both of those guys, while they were top 100 recruits, are not at the level where I can say with authority that, like, yes, for sure, those guys will hit. They may be like Sam Howell was that kind of guy. Like, we ranked him the top 100, but I couldn't tell you for sure he was going to hit, and it looks like he's going to hit. So I just think, yes, it's nice you have depth, but I'm not ready to just sort of say that Texas is set at quarterback for the next 3 years.
I don't really have much more that I can add to that Barton didn't already say. Other than, I didn't draft Sam Ehlinger because I never had him on my board.
Yikes.
It's not, I mean, I have nothing against him. I'm not as high on him as I know you are, Chip, and some other people are. I think he's a lot. I feel like when it comes to Ehlinger, there are two schools of thought, which is typically the case when it comes to Texas, because there's Texas fans and then there's everybody else. I think that he's good. He's not as good as some people believe, nor is he horrible, which is what a lot of people want you to believe. I think he's a very solid quarterback at the college level, but I would not, he's not in my top five of who I would want. No.
He is video game like in the way that if I was controlling him, everything's running through him. Like, we're just, everything is going to run through him. He is going to be responsible for almost all of our offense. We need him to run. We need him to pass. We need him to figure out ways to go and get us the third downs and the touchdowns and goal line situations. I don't know. I love it. He's an iconic college quarterback.
Yeah, Tom, all that matters is, do you think he's iconic?
No.
Oh.
What?
Sorry. No.
That is grounds for a fight.
Sorry. I think he's a perfectly fine quarterback.
You don't have to get on here and start talking about how good of a player he is, but I'll be damned if you're going to say he's not iconic.
How many Instagram followers does he have?
I don't know.
And the best analysis isn't Instagram followers. It's how many youth-sized jerseys have been sold at Roses in the state of Texas. How many knockoff Texas jerseys have been sold at big department stores with the number 15 on them?
Jerseys have been sold.
I mean, I was really about to start feeling for Jeremy here, because if he was at Texas from 2010 to 2015. That was some lost in the woods time for the Longhorns.
Those the tail end of the Mac Brown years.
When I think of iconic Texas quarterback, I think of Vince Young, and I'm sorry, but I'm not putting Sam Ehlinger in the same category as Vince Young.
That was that would mean that he was at Texas right as the time that the rest of the country was reminding Texas fans that Mack Brown recruited Johnny Manziel as a safety.
And Robert Griffin as a safety. And every other quarterback who seemingly was good and came out of Texas, apparently Mack Brown was recruiting him as a safety. How much of that is true and how much is a meme? We'll never know.
About to have the most athletic secondary in the country.
I mean, if they had picked off passes, they would have been able to throw for touchdowns afterwards.
Great question, Jeremy. I'm glad that it does seem like the immediate future looks good for your Longhorns in the quarterback room. And don't let anybody, including Tom Fornelli, tell you that Sam Ehlinger ain't iconic. All right, next question comes from Rach. Question. When discussing the typical blue bloods of college football, Michigan is typically in that conversation. However, one could argue that Michigan State, not Michigan, has been the more successful program over the last 60 years. Michigan State has not only won more national titles in the last 60 years, but also claims the only college football playoff appearance of the two. Should Michigan be striving to be Michigan State? Oh!
You know what? You could argue that Michigan State is based on the last 60 years. But the problem I have with this argument is that the reason you chose 60 years is that's how far you have to go back to get Michigan State's national title.
That seemed a little bit of a arbitrary number there. 60
I feel like
years specifically, like you like, work in 50s or 100s or 10s. 60 seemed like a pretty specific date there.
What's the name of the person asking this question?
Rach,
I feel like I know which of these two teams you happen to be a fan of. And I will say that you could very much make an argument that Michigan State has been the better program of the two in this century, specifically in the last decade. I think maybe Michigan might have a stronger argument in the first decade of the 21st century. But I think the 2010s definitely belong to Michigan State. But the problem is, yeah, from 2000 to 2009, Michigan State finished one season in the AP poll. Michigan finished 7 seasons in the AP poll. So, nope, got to give the 2000s to Michigan, got to give the 90s to Michigan, got to give the 80s to Michigan, got to give the 70s to Michigan. I'll give Michigan State the 60s. So if we want to go decade by decade, it is 1, 2, 3. It is 4-2 Michigan.
What about the 50s?
50s, that is, this was before Michigan State was the Big Ten was the Big Ten yet, but
Michigan State. See. I mean, you
Michigan State gets the 50s.
Yeah,
They finished in the top 10 of the AP poll 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times.
There you go. They were number 2 in 1951, number 1 in 52, number 3 in 53, number 2 in 55, number 3 in 57. What a 50s juggernaut Michigan State was.
But you got to give Michigan the 40s too. So now we're up to 5-3 in the last 8 decades. I love the spirit of the question. I think you could definitely make the argument that Michigan State has had the better decade, and that is, if I'm you, Rafe or Sage.
Rach.
Yeah, we had Sap earlier and Rach now, so it's confusing. I think that is the argument you should stick to when you're getting into a debate with your Michigan friends, because if you start going back too far in history, the national title discussion doesn't really hold a lot of weight when it's those two in the last 60 years haven't been in 60 years. And am I incorrect? Are those the only two, or did they have a couple in the 50s as well?
Michigan State football claims 1951, 52, 55, 57, 65, and 66.
Okay. So yeah, they've got 6 claims. Yeah, so I mean, if you want to go long haul, you could make that argument. I guess you have better argument than a lot of people probably think off the surface, but
and they get that because of the 11 Michigan claimed national titles, 10 of them were before 1950.
Mm-hmm.
Michigan has won national title since 1950.
1997.
Yeah. Better pick it up, Michigan.
But you also have to realize that for a long time, the national title wasn't nearly as important as winning your conference. The national title was just something that was given to you by like voters. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you could argue that the national title isn't as important now. Remember?
Yeah, no, it's not as you can make that argument, but I think the national title became something that became an actual national obsession among college football fans in the modern era, since like the 90s. I think you could argue that from the 80s before that, winning a national title was awesome. Nobody was upset when they got it. It's just, I don't think that's what most, like, you weren't going into the season with your goal being winning a national title. You just wanted to win your conference.
I think I've told you this before, Tom, but the way that I generally have, and this is floating, I'm open for criticism and or suggestion otherwise, but for the whatever the modern era is, like I consider the Supreme Court decision in 1984 against the NCAA that allowed conferences to be able to sell their own television rights. So like, we're not even to conference networks. We're not even really to the explosion of cable TV, but college football in my eyes becomes really national in the late 80s. And specifically I circle the Notre Dame Miami rivalry of the late 80s as the one thing that beyond just like winning your home games and competing for a conference championship, that was when the sport really took off. And then into the 90s, it continues to explode with more Miami, with Nebraska, with Tennessee, with Florida State. Penn State was really, really good in there too. So I consider the modern era when the national championship really started to matter in a big way to be from the late 80s on.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I just did that post the other day about next 5 teams to win a national title that haven't won it in the modern era. And we used 92 as the beginning of the modern era because that's when the first bowl alliance started, where they were pitting 1 versus 2 in a bowl game. You had the SEC starting a conference championship. And then you also had the rules going in place that were limiting scholarships down to 85 per school. But I don't think there's a definitive modern era point. I think there's arguments for a couple different spots.
So the observation of Michigan and its national championships since 1950 just being one kind of plays into the expectations for Michigan football, or does it? Question from Big Tom Fiorini.
What?
B-I-I-I-G, Big, and then Tom Fiorini, F-I-O-R-I-N-I.
Listen, I'm just going to say that name's a little too similar. I might have to cease and desist.
I know riling up Michigan fans gets good ratings and it's pretty easy to do, but why does the Jim Harbaugh is overrated talk still exist? My answer to that question has always been, it depends on how you rate him. But it actually confuses me why people act like most of the country still thinks he's a top five coach and is massively overrated. In my opinion, he seems to be properly rated, parentheses, top 25-ish coach by most publications at this point, and most Michigan fans would agree with this. There seems to be a lot of anger directed at Harbaugh from non-Michigan fans, like he's some big phony, when in reality, he's been a good, not great coach in his Michigan tenure. Am I off?
I'm not really sure what he's asking, but I think this is a – but any Harbaugh discussion to me is fascinating. First of all, I would push back on the idea that like just ranking Harbaugh in the top 25 satisfies Michigan fans, because I did that. I ranked him like 17th or something, and my mentions were like all over the place from Michigan fans.
Were they not satisfied?
They were not satisfied with that. Now, I may have ranked him too low. I think, like, as we discussed it on the call when we discussed those rankings, like, I may have been sort of convinced into thinking I had him a little bit too low, but I don't think anyone has him in the top 10 anymore. I think he's probably like appropriately ranked in the sort of 15-8 sort of range. But here's the thing with Harbaugh. The reason that he's called overrated is because when he arrived at Michigan, I think people, myself included, thought that Harbaugh's arrival was analogous to the arrival of Urban Meyer or Nick Saban, or name your elite national championship is an inevitability coach. And it before long we realized like that isn't necessarily what we're going to get here. And so I think the process of adjusting your expectations from that into just really good coach has taken some time. But like so then the response would be like, well, then just everyone was just stupid for having the opinion that he was that good of a coach, that he's a top four coach when he arrived. Well, I want to go over Harbaugh's resume, because in preparation for this question, like it's his resume before he arrived at Michigan was phenomenal. Like, it was, this is going to be a national title coach. It's not a matter of this, it's a matter of when. Hey, it still might happen. Like, so let's not rule it out. But when he arrived, I want to defend like anyone who thought that Michigan had just hired an Urban Meyer level coach. His career started at University of San Diego, a 1AA non-scholarship program that it was average, right? In 2002, I have a little bit of personal experience with this. I was on the Yale team that played San Diego, University of San Diego. We beat them 49-14. That was the year before Harbaugh got there. They were terrible. I don't even remember that game. Like, I have pretty vivid memories of most of my games. Like, I don't even remember what happened because it was such a walk in the park. Okay, fast forward 2006, which was his third year there. I was gone at that point at Yale, and that team that killed us in 2002, that Yale team went 6-4. We were average. In 2006, a Yale team that went 8-2 and tied for the Ivy League title and finished 25th in the country in the 1AA rankings got beat by San Diego 43-17. That's just 3 years after that. Okay, so San Diego was 11-1 his last 2 years there. Not only that, Josh Johnson is, I think, still cashing a check in the NFL as a quarterback. So he developed, recruited, whatever, a quarterback that went on to be a veteran in the NFL at San Diego, his first stop. Then he takes over Stanford, 1-11 the year before he gets there, 12-1 the year he leaves. All right, that's the Luck, Toby Gerhardt era. His the quarterback he recruits on his way out the door is Kevin Hogan, who goes on to get drafted in the NFL draft. So Josh Johnson, Andrew Luck, Kevin Hogan, those are his quarterbacks so far. He takes a 5-5 team at San Diego to 11-1. He takes a 1-11 team to 12-1 at Stanford. Then he goes to the 49ers, a team that the year before he gets there was 6-10, third in the NFC West. First year there, they're 13-3, NFC runner-up. Next year, they're the NFC champ. After that, NFC runner-up again. His quarterback's there, Alex Smith, who he turned into a really good player, obviously, and Colin Kaepernick, who at that point no one was really even talking about as this elite talent, and Jim Harbaugh created this guy, right? He leaves San Francisco after an 8-8 season, whatever, his final year there, goes to Michigan. Michigan had back-to-back 10 wins, hadn't had back-to-back 10-win seasons since 2002-2003. He gets back-to-back 10-win seasons his first 2 years there, and we're going Josh Johnson, Andrew Luck, Kevin Hogan, Alex Smith, Colin Kaepernick, Jake Rudock, who transfers from Iowa to Michigan, gets drafted that year. Every quarterback he's touched at this point is successful. Like, you can sort of critique Kevin Hogan or Jake Rudock all you want, but those guys got drafted. Those guys cashed checks in the NFL that he developed or produced in college. The resume to that point, like, and by the way, second year there was the year that they had another 10-win season, and it took overtime to be like they almost knocked off Ohio State. That was that like a brutally close finish, and it looked like they were literally on the doorstep of. And so right then, I think you're seeing what happened. You're seeing him arrive at Michigan. You're seeing the acceleration of the Michigan program. You're seeing how close they are to beating Ohio State. And so at that point, 2 years in, I think he has validated an expectation that things are going to jump off here. And since then, it just hadn't jumped off, especially considering the way things have gone down against Ohio State. But rating him as high as you want up to whatever that year is, 2017 or whatever, is perfectly reasonable, perfectly defensible. Like, explain to me how a rise could be more impressive than what he did in that stretch that I just outlined, 2002 or 2004, I guess, or three, up to like 2017. Like, that's a 15 years that was phenomenal to me.
Yeah, I.
Oh, I know why.
Like, isn't that crazy? Like, but isn't like think about it, like, because right now we're all like we're kind of bash Harbaugh, but I just think it's important to like pull back and look at the and bring some relativity back into this. I knew what it was. But in digging into the resume, I just when you circle back to it and you really like look at it again, that's like, am I wrong? Like, that is
no
incredible in terms of what he accomplished up to that point.
You know, I mean, I've talked about it a lot on this podcast. I think that Jim Harbaugh has done a much better job at Michigan than a lot of people want to give him credit for. But I also think that there is a lot of stuff that he still needs to do that at Michigan that is worth picking, you know, apart on what he does. But I also think that in a way, like, by if you're saying that Harbaugh, you know, if you're just criticizing Harbaugh for not beating Ohio State or saying he hasn't done this, and that's if you're a Michigan fan or somebody else, these are all, you know, warranted critiques and something you should want. But I also think in a way it kind of disrespects what Ohio State has done. Because Ohio State has taken itself to a position in the Big Ten and nationally where it is one of those elite programs. So most teams aren't beating Ohio State. So when you critique Jim Harbaugh for not doing it, that's mostly based on the hype surrounding him going into the hire and Michigan just being Ohio State's primary rival. And I think if you just look at it as a vacuum, it's like, well, yeah, he hasn't beat the team that nobody beats. That's really not something you should hold against him.
So I think that some of the overrated talk comes as a bit of backlash to his behavior and his moves when he arrived at Michigan, because the satellite camps was a thing that drove coaches crazy. And he came in and he started to make big splashes on the recruiting trail. Top 10 classes in 2016, top 10 class in 2017, top 10 class in 2019. He was doing some real work, leaving the state of Michigan, going into other people's neighborhoods and getting recruits. It was the antics of him having sleepovers. Remember when he climbed the tree so that he could talk to the recruit through the window? He was walking around at these camps, these satellite camps, with his shirt off and his khakis on. I think that there was a level of showmanship that he was bringing. The milk and the steak. Remember, he was jumping all in on he was a big tweeter early on.
Was that Jim Harbaugh being a showman, or was that stuff all being covered because of the public's appetite for Jim Harbaugh?
No, I think
he's toned it down. I don't think it's just we've tired of it. I don't think that we have tired of it. I think he's toned that down.
I think at the time he was like, all right, I'm going to be as out there as he was very much embracing the idea of like any publicity is good publicity. Because it was going to help recruiting. And I think he's probably backed off that a little bit.
He has. I mean, the Jim Harbaugh has made more headlines in the last 2 years for players' rights, for social justice, and sort of standing with his current players and former players, including Colin Kaepernick and others, than he has for these wacky recruiting stories. But, you know, and where I'm at fault, you know, the college football blogosphere is at fault because, you know, in 2015, 2016, woo boy, that Harbaugh content was hitting. People were clicking on it. Out here chasing a bag of clicks, and we were just getting all of it from the Harbaugh stuff. It was 100% a chicken and egg scenario, but I think that all of those antics and him really thriving on getting under the skin of SEC coaches for the way that he was marching into SEC country on these tours for these satellite camps, I think that that probably has as much to do with lingering feelings of overrated, because he's not being judged against his record the way that you just laid out, Barton. He's being judged against the idea of Jim Harbaugh.
Right. And I think, yes. And he's still got a chance. He's still got a chance to circle back into that really elite tier. He just has to break through. He has to get to the playoffs, whatever. But I think the thing that I is think like the thing that I that my rant was defending, and not that it was a rant, but it was defending the idea that he deserved to be rated where he was when he first arrived. Like, it wasn't a miss. It wasn't like media just falling in love with a non-substantive Harbaugh for the sake of like clicks or whatever when we were calling him this game-changing coach that arrived in Michigan. All the evidence was pointing to him being a game-changing coach when he arrived in Michigan. And he's – I don't know that he's changed the game, but he's improved things for sure.
Any other Harbaugh thoughts?
Michigan is a better football program now than it was when he took over.
That is –
now, it's not good enough for what a lot of people want or expected. But if you can't deny that Michigan is in a much better position right now than it was when he first took over.
The Wolverines, in his 5 years, twice, they have shown up to play Ohio State in the final game of the year with a chance to play for a Big Ten championship. Now, once, they did kind of get blasted. Buckeyes hung 62 on the board. But to your point, in 2016, they were close. They were awfully, awfully close. Remember, if you want to jump in on a future mailbag episode, the way that you're going to be able to do that is by going to the Cover 3 College Football Podcast, 5-star review. Within the review, leave your mailbag question, and we will add it to the big old bag of mail. You can follow him on Twitter at Barton Simmons. You can follow him at Tom Finelli. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Shout out Burnley +250.
Thank you. MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.